from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
I've been sitting all night listening to my records, making up my mind to call you up, but I'm never on time, and it's too late for tonight.
Slick country music singers get half naked and wiggle like rock stars these days, but the image of female country singers in beehive hairdos and ball gowns remains for fans and hecklers alike. That's just fine with singer and songwriter Laura Cantrell. She's making an unusual retro career with an unadorned voice, steel pedal twang, and the hill country austerity of old school country. But you won't find her with a grocery cart full of kids and a super long Virginia Slim at the Piggly Wiggly. She's one of a growing breed of country music artists pushing back against Nashville's airbrushed mainstream music. And she doesn't live in Nashville anymore. If Kitty Wells made Rubber Soul, it would sound like Laura Cantrell, said pop rocker Elvis Costello in a particularly zen moment. Laura Cantrell was raised on the posh side of Nashville and went to an Ivy League school in New York City. For a decade after college, she wore a business suit to a fancy Wall Street job by day and sang austere mid-century Appalachian tunes by night. From Jersey City, she still traces the musical backroads on her weekly radio show, Radio Thrift Shop, bringing the country to the city in song. Tonight on Point, a conversation with Laura Cantrell, Nashville girl in the heart of New York.
I can see the sky so clearly now, the silver empire moon.
Joining me now from New York City is country music singer, songwriter, and recording artist Laura Cantrell. Good evening and welcome, Laura.
Well, hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for being with us. So how does it happen that a one-time Wall Street banker gets Elvis Costello effusing about her in such terms? I've been spending the morning thinking about Kitty Wells and Rubber Soul. You had all kinds of attention in the UK early on. John Peel, the big British disc jockey, effusing, calling your first record, my favorite record in the last 10 years, possibly my life. Why were these guys talking about you? How did they find you, Laura Cantrell?
Well, you know, it's still sort of mind-blowing to me, but I was basically an artist doing country music who couldn't really get arrested in the United States. So I had the good fortune to have an independent label in the UK, the Glasgow-based Shoeshine Records, that wanted to put out my music.
And this is still when you're a vice president at Bank of America Securities, business manager of equity research.
Yes, I was.
With a label in Glasgow.
It's pretty good. I know, it's really the most unlikely set of different circumstances you could cram into one story, I think. But that opportunity to release the music there really gave me a chance to kind of take a serious look at what I was doing and how much I wanted to get to travel and perform. And also it brought the music to the BBC and to John Peel and to the record shops of the UK, which is where Elvis found it. So, you know, it's really something I hadn't really envisioned for myself, but by sort of happy accident, here we are. So,
well, the reviews are in and they're great. Everybody, you know, this voice that's precious and businesslike, they're still playing with you on your business past, I think, the USA Today. New York Times says wise, sweetly troubled, Sunday Times clear, understated voice. And then there's this from Rolling Stone, which is just crazy about Laura Cantrell, a modern woman with an old-timey heart. You've got a wonderful range. We want to hear a lot of it tonight. But let's get something just to give a sense of that range off your first CD, Not the Trembling Kind. Let's listen to just a little bit of Big Wheel. This is co-authored, you and your husband, Jeremy Tepper, who, if yes, I understand it right, has a studio that puts out trucker songs.
Yes, so the world-renowned Diesel Only Records for its truck-driving 45s.
Let's get a little taste of Big Wheel.
I feel like a big wheel.
Laura Cantrell, Big Wheel from her first album, Not the Trembling Kind. Her album last year was When the Roses Bloom Again, and we'll hear more of that before the night is out. So here you are, Nashville girl, but not from the wrong side of the tracks or the other side of the tracks or anything else. Two lawyers for parents and growing up in West Nashville suburbs, off to New York and then back to country. What was that about, Laura Cantrell? Did you get homesick and decided you need to have some country in your New York apartment?
To kind of simplify the story, yes, you could say that in a way. I had the experience that a lot of folks who travel from the South and sort of identify themselves as Southern do when they leave that sort of Southern culture behind them, which is kind of what it felt like when I came to go to school in New York City. It was a way for me to connect with what I felt like was the culture of my family and kind of with the history of the place. It's, you know, it's a kind of a interesting, troubled history. So, you know, it's to sort of understand it through the music was something that seemed interesting when I was a college kid, just starting to listen to Hank Williams records and the Carter Family and what have you. And I kind of got hooked.
It's funny how that happens. I read that in your household growing up, this was not the music of the house. Your parents had more serious, I shouldn't say more serious, but they had different musical tastes. But as somebody who came from Mid-America, farmland to the city myself, I know that funny feeling where you're reaching not just for the music of your parents, but for the music of a region to kind of touch base with it again. It made me want to ask you, if country music, given your path, is it the birthright of all Americans, of any American? Do you have to earn the right to sing country music?
Well, I think that I could get as agitated as any other naysayer about some of the modern country music and how it kind of uses what I think are sort of stereotypes of rural life to basically find its own demographic. And that is something that I think is kind of fake.
Playing the market.
Yeah, I think that bugs me when I see that happen. At the same time, I think country music is a very directly expressive, emotional. It is a sort of form of soul music. And I think anybody that can communicate that way has the right to sing it or can get its message from it. So, you know, that was one thing that was very interesting to me coming to New York City. Mm-hmm. I was at Columbia in the 80s and did college radio there. And through the fans of the campus radio station, I found that there were many generations of country music fans who'd, you know, lived in Queens and heard their first country music when they went off to Southern Army camps as they were getting shipped out to World War II or whatever.
Right.
You know, there's millions of ways that people first sort of discover or become aware of country music. And there were a lot of those folks in New York City, and they had nothing to do with having grown up in this authentic rural setting. So it kind of widened my own view of what a country music fan could be.
Laura Cantrell, how do you describe the difference between what you do and where mainstream country music is these days?
Well, I think, you know, I'm trying to do something that's pretty simple, and I think of it as simple and direct and kind of harkening back to the kind of older styles of country music. But at the same time, I'm not trying to just recreate a style for the sake of a style, and I'm trying to, in my own kind of fumbling way, find a way to sort of express, you know, express the point of view of a young person living in this time, but through this type of music.
Do you do that? Do you find your own angle on this music by fully inhabiting country music, if we can put it that way, or by opening up a little distance, a little kind of conscious alienation from the music as you sing it?
I do think that that's part of the process. You know, a lot of folks, especially I think young people when they're in college, when they first hear some older country music, the first way you hear it is sort of in an ironic way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can hear George and Tammy singing We're Not the Jet Set. You
it's
know,
easy to send it up.
It's very easy to send it up. And I think that that's the way a lot of folks come in. And some people never get over that first way of enjoying it. And I feel like I can be in that type of appreciation of it myself. But I also have tried to go deeper with it and tried to get beyond what it is as a sort of kitschy, colorful surface to, you know, what's beneath it, which I think is pretty deep and dark and rich. So
I'd say, I know you've got your guitar there in the studio in New York. We want to hear a song as we head into a break here from your latest album, When the Roses Bloom Again. It's called Mountain Fern. You wrote it. Tell us the story of this song.
This song was written sort of in tribute to one of the great lady singers. Her name's Molly O'Day, and she left the music business before she was as famous as she would have been because she was a wonderful artist.
1940s singer.
Yes, she was a singer in the late 40s. But she left the business because of her very strong fundamentalist Christian religious beliefs. So I just always thought she was an interesting person. And
you've heard from her family since it came out.
Actually, I did. I had the pleasure and an honor, because you never know when you're writing about someone who has a real history would think of it or what their family would think of it. Molly O'Day's been dead since the 70s, but her family got in touch with me and said how much they appreciated the song. So it was really validating to have that appreciation kind of communicated back to me
through the
modern marvel of the internet.
Let's hear it. This is Mountain Fern from When the Roses Bloom Again, Laura Cantrell.
She left her home on the mountain as a young girl, and she traveled and rambled all through the wide world. And the world was Kentucky, then Tennessee, West Virginia to Texas, and everything in between. And her name would be different from place to place, and her heart might get heavy sometime, with a worn prayer book in her guitar case, in a boarding house room, the banjo she plays, and the she found fame and fortune on the radio wave. Well, it never came easy, and she longed to be safe. And those hills of Knoxville with their fine white mist settled over everything, put a chill in her heart like the devil's kiss. In morning light she turned to the king, and the wind blows a mountain fern, and she sways and bends in the breeze, and our Dixie darling is calling. She's fallen right down to her knees. She finally knows who to please, and it feels so good just to hear your voice rise. Joyful noise, and I hope someday you will understand why my song must be sung for him, played for him, written for him.
singer-songwriter Laura Cantrell. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with singer-songwriter Laura Cantrell, a beautiful retro voice of country music with a dash of New York City. In the background is Don't Break the Heart from Laura Cantrell's latest CD, When the Roses Bloom Again.
Don't make the fatal error of thinking you'll find someone better, 'cause you won't. Don't break the heart that needs you.
That's fun. That's country. Laura Cantrell, I wish you'd just walk us through the steps of your transition from Ivy League, Columbia girl away from home in New York City to country singer with two albums. There's a radio show in there. There's a Wall Street stint in there. There must have been a lot of late night songwriting and weekend dashes to New York honky-tonks, if that's not an oxymoron. Unfold it for us. How did it work?
Well, really, it started as you know, I wanted to stay working somehow in radio when I left college. And I knew that the thing that sort of distinguished me, I guess, from other people who wanted to work in the public radio business was my kind of deeper knowledge of country music. Mm-hmm. So that ended me up at WFMU in East Orange, now in Jersey City, mm-hmm. New Jersey, a great freeform station that really lets their DJs specialize and whatever their musical obsessions are. So,
and your show, Radio Thrift Shop, very eclectic and very popular early on in 93, became popular on the web and all over the city.
Yes, we've been really lucky to have a great audience, both locally and as the internet audience has grown, you know, online as well. But that was sort of my sort of first focus.
So now we've got one plate spinning there, which is
right.
your radio show, and it's country and more perhaps. But then the rest?
Well, I found out pretty quickly at WFMU, which is a volunteer organization, and the people there, there were a lot of DJs who'd been there for a long time, and they just sorted out another way to make a living so that they could do what they sort of, I called it like an avocation.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of folks who really have dedicated their lives to doing a really high quality program.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of followed that model, and that's what led me just through whatever kind of corporate low level job I could get that would give me some benefits and pay the rent.
Vice president at Bank of America Securities doesn't sound so entirely low level.
Well, I started out at the bottom, very bottom rung. I was an administrative assistant in an investment bank,
mm-hmm.
Starting in the early 90s, working in a part of the finance world that now has become quite controversial, the equity research analyst.
Oh, naughty girl. Naughty, naughty.
Yes. Well, it was an interesting place to be, to say the least, even at the administrative level. And
especially during those wild internet years. I mean,
yes, mm-hmm. yes. And but I became, you know, like a lot of other businesses, the Wall Street side was merging and consolidating. And I ended up, just oddly enough, in my same job that I'd had all those years, the sort of longest running assistant. And they kind of moved me up the food chain to, you know, first manage the assistants and then to help recruit people. And
now,
then
were you already riding at home when that happened as you headed toward VP?
Yes. I always thought of the Wall Street job, as much as I've hung around and kind of did achieve some things there.
Mm-hmm.
as a means to an end. So it was, I just really kind of took the path of least resistance. I did what was sort of asked of me. And so as long as they would leave me alone about wanting to commit to a really long-term position, which ironically, I was there for a really long time and ended up with a lot of responsibility. But
while that's going on, you're playing the clubs in New York. You're touring with Elvis Costello. You're ultimately at the Grand Ole Opry.
That actually kind of, for many years, I was really just in a local band. We did local gigs. It wasn't anything that seriously interfered time-wise with having a day job and doing the program on a weekly basis at WFMU, the radio thrift shop on Saturdays. When I released Not the Trembling Kind in 2000 in the UK, that started to kind of stretch the time boundaries a little bit. I ended up using, all of my vacation time to go travel in the UK and play shows. Mm-hmm. And then, that led to getting an opportunity to do maybe some shows out of town in the US. And then we got the Elvis Costello call, which was really a wonderful thing for me. Personally, I've still kind of considered myself a local New York-based artist and still do to a lot of degree, but it was a great chance to go out to the Midwest and play in these big halls. He's a wonderful performer and also kind of hero of my youth. It was really wonderful.
Of course. Let's hear a little more music as we go. Here's Broken Again from When the Roses Bloom Again, Laura Cantrell. Let's just listen to a bit of this.
I can't be broken again. There'd be nothing left of me. My heart won't stand and it won't bend. And I can't be broken again. Just like the rain, I saw you coming with those clouds.
Laura Cantrell with Broken Again. Laura, I've got to ask you about this wonderful kind of flat affect that you've got in this song and any number of your other songs. And at first, I had to shift gears, to get in there with you. But once I did, I absolutely loved it. But what's that about? Is that on purpose? Is that the way you see it? Is that the way you hear it?
Well, I'm not a very I don't have a lot of tricks in my singing kind of toolkit, mm-hmm. So I feel like
not a lot of curly cues.
Yeah, I'm not a very decorative singer, and I don't have tremendous great pipes or what have you. But I've tried to really make as much kind of pack as much kind of communication as possible.
There's a lot
into
of
what I can do. So
plenty of that. But I wondered, is this some kind of postmodern signaling here, where she turns down the amplitude on all the decorative stuff and just
truthfully, if I could do some of that stuff, like I'm a great fan of singers like, maybe Julie Miller, Buddy and Julie Miller, or Emmylou Harris, those kind of folks. Even, you know, there are a lot of more mainstream Nashville singers are really, truly great singers.
Yeah.
But I can't do, like, a lick of that stuff. So I've just had to figure out what I can do.
Well, love your limits, Laura Cantrell. Love them because they're working for you there. Right on that line, I wanted to ask, on some of these bottom notes, now, again, I didn't know, but there's this kind of – I don't know if we heard it there, but there's this little wobble on some of these notes. And I couldn't tell if you're, again, you're like deliberately trying to communicate emotional frailty. Is this something you picked up from other singers? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, I do. And I wish I could say it was, you know, something by design, but it's really just, you know, I've tried to be, I mean, I've taken singing very seriously because I think it's a great way of communicating. It's very effective. And it's packed with, you know, sort of emotional content. Again, I'm not able to be more acrobatic about it. So I've got my little sort of narrow sort of stretch of what I can do. And,
well,
and that's
working
what it
just
is.
Great. It's working
okay,
just wonderfully. We love it. It's terrific. And I got to say.
I actually think also, you know, if you go back and listen to some of the great singers of country music, technically, yeah. You know, someone like a Kitty Wells or Ernest Tubb, mm-hmm. or even the great Roy Acuff, like if you listen to them, technically, they're not the most perfect type of singers, but they ended up just, you know, sounding real. And there was sort of a rawness about what they did. And I've tried to, without faking that myself, mm-hmm. you know, tried to see what I could do that would be sort of in that vein. So,
well, we love the imperfections. I guess it, that's part of what people have come to kind of be turned off by country music, is how perfectly produced and packaged and zippy it's become.
Yeah, it is. I mean, again, I think that in a way, I think actually Nashville gets the best singers, and I admire their singing abilities of some of the big artists. On the other hand, that's not all about how full your notes are sometimes or what have you. I don't, you know, it's can be about a lot of other things too, mm-hmm. so...
Laura Cantrell, there's a song, the title song from your latest CD, the song is When the Roses Bloom Again, that really struck me as I listened to it, given the context of the times and everything going on, war and the rest that we're living with. And I hope you'll play it for us, but I wish you'd tell us about the history of this song a little bit. There's disputed authorship here. It's by way of Woody Guthrie and Wilco, and how did it come to you?
I actually first heard this song from a singer named Sally Timms, who is a member of the great punk rock band, the Mekons. I asked her where she got it because I thought it was such a lovely song. And she told me that it was a piece that Jeff Tweedy and Wilco mm-hmm. had written music for that, you know, some lyrics they'd found in the Woody Guthrie archives when they were working on the Mermaid Avenue project with Billy Bragg.
And it is a war song.
It is
or
a war
Johnny
song.
Goes off to war kind
it's,
of song.
Exactly. It's, and it's kind of interesting because if you really look at the words, they don't seem like Woody Guthrie kind of, you know, they're even a little more sentimental, I think, than Woody Guthrie is. But I can understand why he would have responded to them and at least written them down in his own notebook and kind of thought about what the words are, because it is a sort of classic, the lover's part and promise to return and the soldier goes off to war and, of course, the worst happens. But when we decided to record the song, that was about what I knew of it. But I started looking around. They had figured out that Woody Guthrie hadn't written the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And so they weren't able to include it in their own Mermaid Avenue collection, either one of those albums that they put out. And I started to look around. There was a Carter Family claim to the song. And I did find a Johnny Cash version of the song that was credited to the Carters. Oddly enough, I never found a Carter version with the exact same lyrics. There were very similar ones. There was
right.
about 10, you know, Roses Blooming songs in the Carter Family catalog, but I couldn't find the exact one.
Well, I wish you'd sing it for us. It's a beautiful song, and I know you've got your guitar there. It made me emotional the more I listened to it, and I realized it was because we do have a war going on, and we see the pictures and we hear the stories, and we know, you know, 100,000 plus mainly young men, women too. And it's dusty and it's hot and it's dangerous and it's lonely and they also die. And if you don't mind, it's a little corny, but we'd like to dedicate this song to those soldiers.
Surely.
When the Roses Bloom Again, Laura Cantrell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're strolling in the gloaming when the roses are in bloom. A soldier and his sweetheart, brave and true. And their hearts are filled with sorrow, for their thoughts are of tomorrow. As she pins a rose upon his coat of blue. Do not ask me, love, to linger when you know not what to say. For duty calls your sweetheart's name again, and your heart need not be signed that I'll be among the dying. I'll be with you when the roses bloom again. With the rattle of the battle came a whisper, soft and low. Our soldier, he has fallen in the fray. I am dying, Captain, dying, and I know I have to go, but I want to tell you before I pass away. There's a far and distant river where the roses are in bloom, and a sweetheart who is waiting there for me. And it's there I pray you'll take me. I'll be faithful, don't forsake me. I'll be with you when the roses bloom again. When the roses bloom again, and the sun is on the river, the mockingbird will sing its sweet refrain. And in the days of all anxiety, I'll be with you, sweetheart mine. Oh, I'll be with you when the roses bloom again.
Beautiful song, Laura Cantrell singing When the Roses Bloom Again, played tonight right here for the soldiers in Iraq. And it's easy to resonate, I think, off that, Laura, with the emotions of everybody who's got loved ones there and the many who have now lost loved ones there. 528 U.S. soldiers dead there as of tonight. Laura Cantrell, we've got to take a short break. It's great to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for this program comes from Sophist Antivirus.
VP turned country music artist Laura Cantrell. In the background is Early Years from When the Roses Bloom Again.
The 3 years that I love you were the best years. Oh, the early days. Yes, those early days when I hung around, followed you around, trying to catch a sound of your warm voice coming through my radio. I went to the nightclubs and the studios, and somehow I knew I would make it so that you would love me in the sweetest way. One night you let me pick you up nice and easy. I knew the time had come that you would love me some.
Laura Cantrell, whose early years are you singing about here?
Well, I was kind of thinking when I first started working on that song that I wanted it to be kind of about Merle Haggard and Bonnie Owens, and I was thinking it was sort of from the point of view of Merle Haggard, and as I sort of worked through it, I realized that I didn't feel that comfortable writing from Merle's point of view. So I backed up a little bit, and I sort of made it about, you know, there's some personal things in it, but it kind of also has the setting of kind of a California feel.
It's a pretty song.
Thank you.
You spend a lot of time now singing and working through the record bins with your radio show. It leaves me wanting to ask you in particular what it is about American life, about American history, that country catches that the rest of media misses.
That's a really good question. I don't know if I can quite articulate what it is. I guess there's something to be said for the idea that it's music about sort of working class America, which is something that other types of pop music maybe don't touch on. Mm-hmm. And it does have, obviously, the idea of country music kind of comes from the rural American styles of music that really developed on their own before there was a music business to catalog them and make them into the commodity that they are.
And I love the way irony gets drained away. I love the way it can be more straightforward. The big signature tune off your first CD was The Whiskey Makes You Sweeter. Was written by Mose Allison's daughter, Amy Allison. It must have been a big hit when you played it live in the halls.
Absolutely, and I do think of this as a great example. There's something undisputable about what a great country song this is. It's a drinking song. It's from a woman's point of view. It kind of nails the whole emotional picture that it tries to paint.
Well, it's Friday night, and we're ready for that. So
yes.
Give it to us. The Whiskey Makes You Sweeter.
Okay. Well, the whiskey makes you sweeter than you are. If I quit drinking sooner, I'm sure I wouldn't have gone that far. But now the haze is lifted, I can see that the whiskey makes you sweeter than you could ever really be. I started slow and steady. I went from cola to a beer. I made a resolution from the liquor I steer clear. But when I saw you, something deep inside of me switched on. And when I switched to the whiskey, well, then I knew that I was gone. 'Cause the whiskey makes you sweeter than you are. If I quit drinking sooner, I'm sure I wouldn't have gone that far. But now the haze is lifted, I can see that the whiskey makes you sweeter than you could ever really be. Sweets for a sweetheart, that is what you said to me as you handed me a shot glass and I drank down hungrily. I was lost in dreams of sweet things dancing through my head. And if it wasn't for the whiskey, then I'd have run away instead. 'Cause the whiskey makes you sweeter than you are. If I quit drinking sooner, I'm sure I wouldn't have gone that far. But now the haze is lifted, I can see that the whiskey makes you sweeter
than you could ever really be. Oh yes, a whiskey makes you sweeter than you ever were to me.
Laura Cantrell singing "The Whiskey Makes You Sweeter." Wow, it's great. I love that gal's perspective. It's just wonderful. Laura Cantrell, Nashville girl in the big city, it's been just fabulous spending a Friday night with you. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, Tom, it was my pleasure. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Really a lot of fun. Keep writing, keep playing, and hope you'll come back sometime.
Great.
Thanks. We've been talking with singer-songwriter Laura Cantrell. We'll leave you tonight with "Oh So Many Years," originally sung in the 1950s by Kitty Wells and Webb Pierce. This version is from Laura Cantrell's newest release, "When the Roses Bloom Again." For more on Laura Cantrell, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
For these many years I've loved you, no one has ever known.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
For the second time in a few days, a New England Patriot has won on the road.
If the American people give me a shot at George Bush next November, I will give them back the White House. It is
the results are in. We have won. Oklahoma is okay by me.
Am I disappointed? Naturally. But am I proud of what we stood for in this campaign? You bet I am.
What the court did today was make it crystal clear that lesbian and gay people aren't treated equally unless they are included fully in societal institution of marriage.
This ruling is deeply troubling. The president is firmly committed to protecting and defending the sanctity of marriage. He strongly believes that marriage is a sacred institution between a man and a woman.
I'll be honest, I was happy to see that happen at a Janet Jackson thing, because that meant for one night I wasn't the biggest boob on CBS.
Unfortunately, the whole thing went wrong in the end. I am really sorry if I offended anyone. That was truly not my intention.
Many people in Israel have been very firm against political developments that are seen to be weakening Israel's resolve. To dismantle 17 communities would be a step in the wrong direction. I think he'd be in for a very, very hard inter-political fight.
As the world knows by now, the impact of inhaled ricin, to the best of us, is over a very short period of time, and we are well beyond that window now, 48 hours after the time of exposure.
It is with the deepest sense of sorrow, anguish, and regret that I have chosen to appear before you in order to atone for some of the anguish and pain that has been suffered by the people of Pakistan.
When the facts of Iraq are all in, we will neither be completely right nor completely wrong.
What we've learned thus far has not proven Saddam Hussein had what intelligence indicated and what we believed he had. But it also has not proven the opposite.
Knowing what I knew then and knowing what I know today, America did the right thing in Iraq.
I believe the Independent Commission ought to look to see whether there was abuse by political leaders of the data. I think that is an important question that needs to be understood.
And there it is. The Democratic presidential race heats up with John Kerry, John Edwards, and Wesley Clark announcing victories, Senator Joe Lieberman quitting the campaign trail. The Massachusetts High Court rules that civil unions are no substitute for gay marriage. David Letterman and The Nation react to Janet Jackson's peek-a-boob moment at the Super Bowl halftime show. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon proposes removing settlements from the Gaza Strip. Hawks push back. Deadly ricin poison found in the mailroom of Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist's office. AQ Khan, the father of Pakistan's nuclear weapons program, publicly admits to spreading nuclear secrets to Iran, Libya, and North Korea. And CIA Director George Tenet, Donald Rumsfeld, President Bush, and David Kaye chime in as the controversy over WMD and the U.S. of invasion of Iraq rages on. Jack Beatty, plenty going on this week, right across the board.
Yes, and from that snippet of Director Tenet, he's really answering David Kaye from last week. David Kaye said, we were all wrong. The director, CIA, said our record was mixed. David Kaye said, our job is 85% completed. Director Tenet says, no, nothing like that. And then Donald Rumsfeld says, yes, it is 85% completed. It's a strange time for Tenet to be talking ambiguity, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Ambiguity after the fact, certainty before. Although in his defense, he says we were not pressured. He does say that. But on the other hand, he says we never said it was an imminent threat, which really does create distance between him and the White House.
But interesting, this former David Kaye not going quiet here. He's answering right back on the same day saying, hey, let's look at how policy was made here. It sounds like he may just keep talking.
He may indeed, and he was further, he made an even better riposte, I thought, to the specifics of what Director Tenet said. He said, if there are not, then don't go about connecting them, which metaphysically gets right at it, doesn't it? I mean, the director says our record was mixed, but where are the dots?
Fascinating. The word is out that John McCain may be named to this commission President Bush is putting together. I mean, this is, whenever you hear him speak about President Bush, there's some deep animosity there. It feels as though quite interesting to have him on that commission if he ends up there.
It certainly will give it authority, but of course it's going to report after the election, which is so, I don't know, cynical or patent or whatever you want to call it.
But, all those words apply. On the other hand, it's also revving up this week. The Democrats on display all over the place and making a lot of noise.
They are, and it looks like the story of the year is about to gutter out. That is the rise and fall of Howard Dean. He's pulling out of the Michigan caucus this week. He was expected to do well there. He's telling his supporters he either does well a week from Tuesday in Wisconsin, or it's all over. He may even fold before then. What a story that is, isn't it? Huh?
It is, and not just do well in Wisconsin. He says he has to win there.
He's got to win, yeah.
Who knows? It could happen. I have to think, though, how Howard Dean's energy, and you've got to call it at many levels courage, has infused this debate so far in these last 6 months, really, really lifted it up into something more than it promised to be, it seems to me.
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, the other candidates have really taken some of his heat. I mean, when they talk about President Bush now, it is with a sense that they're competing with Howard Dean with his dismissive statements, and that's what Democratic voters seem to want to hear.
Whether you love or hate the guy, he had a kind of clarifying impact on the debate. We're going to have more of a debate, more of a flat-out debate between the parties than we've had in a long time. It looks as though at this point.
It sure does, and the debate is on this weekend with President Bush on Meet the Press for the first time.
Well, we'll see that. We'll be watching. Jack, thanks for being with us. Talk to you next week.
Thank you.
It's On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks worldwide for over 10 years. Information available at